Our scripture reading for the fifth Sunday of Lent is taken from John chapter 11, and this is the story of the death of Lazarus and Jesus resurrecting him. Now, Jesus had received word from Mary and Martha, who are the sisters of Lazarus, and they informed Jesus that Lazarus is sick and dying, and they asked Jesus to come to Bethany in order to heal him. Jesus, however, receives this message, and then he chooses to wait 2 days before he shows up. And so now we pick up the story at John chapter 11, verse 17, where Jesus arrives in Bethany after Lazarus is already dead. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, "If you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord," she replied, "I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world." And now verse 32. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. Now verse 38. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days." Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you will always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." Here ends our reading. May God add his blessing to it. One of the most popular TV shows in recent TV history is the CSI series, Crime Scene Investigation. And in this show, it tells the story of how police use science and technology to solve crimes. And the investigators will take one or two very small pieces of evidence, like a strand of hair or a drop of blood or perhaps even a voice sample, and they will then submit those samples to all kinds of tests, and they will mine all kinds of information out of that one small little piece of evidence. And you see, the Gospel of John is very much like that. John has a lot of details sprinkled throughout his book. And those details are important. Those details tell a much deeper story. And the story of Jesus raising Lazarus is like that. There are a number of small details in the story that go largely unnoticed. But when you notice them, and when you understand their meaning, it opens up this passage to much greater understanding. Now, this story probably has at least a dozen or more small details that if we were to look at would open up a world of insight. I won't try to look at all of the details. Instead, I'm just going to pick out 6 of those details and explain them one by one and then move on. The first small detail involves the names, Lazarus from Bethany. Now, Lazarus means God helps. And the word Bethany, or the name Bethany, actually means house of affliction. Now, when you pair those two names up, Lazarus of Bethany, it means God helps in the house of affliction. So what does that say to you? Well, it says that the place where God likes to work is in the house of affliction. You know, it's among the afflicted that God does his best work. It's in the graveyards and cemeteries that Jesus does his best work. The psalmist of in Psalm 130 begins by saying, "Out of the depths I cry to you." And what the psalmist realizes is that God does his best work in the depths. So now the plot is set and the story is ready to unfold. Now we come to the next detail of the story. You see, Jesus did not go right away. Instead, he waited for 2 days. He was maybe an hour's walk away from Bethany. But why did he wait? It's not because he didn't want to go. There were probably several reasons for delaying the trip. One was this was near the end of Jesus' ministry, and he had won a great deal of fame and recognition, but he had also been acquiring a lot of opposition. And so it might not have been safe to travel at that point in time. His miracles were well known, and people were taking notice, and people were beginning to oppose him, trying to expose him as a false prophet. But I think the main reason why Jesus waited is the reason he stated, that he wanted to make sure that everyone knew Lazarus was good and dead, that he had been in the tomb for 4 days, and everyone would know without a doubt that Lazarus was dead, and that when he was resurrected from death and not a coma. Now, the faith lesson behind this little detail is this: sometimes God delays the answer to some of our prayers. I know he does that to me all the time. You know, the type of prayer where we have tried everything we can do and we finally give up trying. We give up trying to change things or change people or fix people or fix the situation. And we finally give up and say, "All right, Lord, I can't do this. I'm going to have to rely on you." Now is when God can act. And there is no doubt that when we receive an answer to a prayer like that, where we have tried everything and nothing works, when we do get the answer, there's no doubt that God was behind the answer and not our own cleverness. Now let's take a look at verse 33. Jesus arrives and he has a discussion with both Mary and Martha. Martha begins by saying, "Lord, you know, if he were here, my brother would not have died, or he would have recovered." And at verses 33 through 35, actually 32 through 35, it says, "When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.' When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who'd come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. 'Where have you laid him?' he asked. 'Come and see, Lord,' they replied. Jesus wept." Jesus wept. That is the shortest verse in the entire New Testament. It's just two little words, but it contains a world of meaning. Why would Jesus weep? He already knows how the story is going to end. It's not like he's never going to see Lazarus ever again. But what this tells us is this, that Jesus is not just some talking head. He is a real live person who experiences real live emotions, and our emotions affect him. Jesus wept because he was sympathizing and empathizing with the people who had lost Lazarus. And so the next time you're in prayer, and your emotions are running high and fast, understand this: Jesus gets it. And he is moved by those emotions. Remember that amazing fact that our emotions affect Jesus and that he understands our feelings. We're not going to a God who is unacquainted with our hardships, but rather one who has experienced all the hardships we have. So they take Jesus to Lazarus' tomb, and Jesus says, "Roll away the stone." Now, this is the part of the story where it kind of makes me scratch my head. You know, he is about to raise Lazarus from the dead. I mean, this profound, earth-shattering miracle. And he asked someone else to roll the stone away? I mean, couldn't Jesus have rolled the stone away himself? I mean, wouldn't that have been an extra plus to just really, you know, amp up that miracle. But what this says is this: God intends for us to help build his kingdom, and he involves us in the ministry of his kingdom, even the miracles. So the next time you hear about some miracle, I want you to notice how God has used people in that miracle. It may have just been a happenstance, you know, someone just passing by. But more importantly, the next time you feel that God is moving you to do something that you don't quite understand, that might be a little bit scary, that just might be God involving you in one of his miracles. Now the stone gets rolled away, and Jesus calls Lazarus to come out. And when Lazarus comes out, his hands and feet are wrapped in strips of linen. There's a cloth around his face. And Jesus says, "Take off the grave clothes." Now, here is a minor detail that escaped me for many years, and it escapes most people. And I believe the reason why is because it takes a little bit of understanding in the Greek of the New Testament. The original word in the New Testament that Jesus used for take off is lusete. And lusete is a phrase that means take off, but it's a word, but the word in the original Greek is different. That is the same word that Jesus used was the same word that you would use to say, let a prisoner go, or to release an animal from its cage. You know, and that was important. Why? Because the listeners at this event were a combination of common folks and some who were in the leadership class. And at that time, there were two different ways of practicing one's faith. They were all Jews, so they were one faith, but there were two different ways of practicing or living out their faith in daily life. One is called legalism, and the other is fatalism. Now, legalism is what the Jewish leaders did. The way to heaven is to do these rules, follow them, A, B, and C, X, Y, and Z. Fatalism, on the other hand, is a belief that one's fate is already set, and whatever will be will come to be, and nothing's going to change that. You see, this was the practice of the common people. They felt that they were just this cog in the machinery of life. And the problem with both of these approaches to living out one's faith, both of these are dysfunctional. They're dysfunctional ways of practicing our faith, because neither fatalism or legalism, neither one allows for God to work. Both fatalism and legalism diminish the glory of God. And neither fatalism or legalism acknowledges God's power to save. Legalism says it's all about the rules. Follow the rules and you'll be fine. Whereas as fatalism says, hey, life's tough. Get a helmet. Now, both of these are popular ways of practicing our faith today. I see a lot of legalism. I also see a lot of fatalism in the church. You know, I see legalism in something that I call the worship wars. On the one hand, you have people who find a great deal of inspiration and fulfillment in the contemporary form of worship music. And then you, on the other side, you have the traditionalists, the people who like the traditional hymns and liturgy. And they will look at each other and say, I don't get that. You know, what they're doing is wrong. You know, the contemporary people will look at the traditionalists and say, you know, they're not really worshiping God. They have no joy. And the traditionalists will look at the contemporary worshipers and they'll say, well, that's just Christian entertainment. That's not really worship. If you're going to approach God, you need to be serious. That's how I see legalism playing out in the church today. Now, what about fatalism? Well, I see that as well. I'm going to tell you a story. I did a funeral for a man by the name of Dell. And Dell was a well-known person. He was well-liked. And Dell had passed away at the age of 71. Now, in today's day and age, 71 is a relatively young age. I would call that premature death, because with all the science and technology and medicine, people are living far beyond 71 on a regular basis. Plus the fact that Dell had longevity in his genes. His father lived to be 95 years old, and his mother lived to be 98. And he had a much older brother who was still alive, who was well into his 80s. And so Dell had longevity in his genes. And everyone at the funeral was saying, well, you know, it was premature, but I guess this is God's timing. It's just God's timing. Well, I want to tell you something about good old Dell. Dell smoked with impunity. He drank to excess oftentimes. He overate every single day, and he never exercised. If this was God's timing, Dell was certainly doing a whole lot of stuff to help God out. You see, it wasn't just God's timing. Not only does fatalism cut God out of the picture and dishonor him, it also excuses us from our responsibilities, just like in the example I just gave you. So let me ask you this. What has you bound up as a prisoner, spiritually speaking? Is it legalism? Has faith just become a lot of rules and you're trying to follow those rules, but you're failing? Are you bound up and a prisoner of fatalism, that life is just a game and it's going to play me? Or is there something else that has taken you prisoner? Say, chronic worry. Or perhaps chronic regret. You're always dwelling on the past and regretting what happened and wishing you could change it. Maybe it's some sinful habit. Or maybe it's a relationship. Whatever it is, I want you to hear the good news that Jesus wants to set you free and give you a new life. Why? Because he understands those feelings, and our feelings affect him. And you say, well, you know, that's going to take a miracle. And yes, it probably will take a miracle. But you see, Jesus has a plan to set you free. And that plan may involve a miracle. And that miracle may involve other people. And it might also require your cooperation. Thank you for listening. Amen.